So whenever I'm in a new situation where I'm asked to participate in an icebreaker that essentially wants me to share something unique about myself, I always, always, always am tempted to say, "Hey everyone, my name's Trisha, and I grew up in a doomsday apocalyptic cult." But the truth is, I never say it. And it's not because I want to keep that part of my life hidden. It's just that the word cult is so loaded and so cringy to me. I mean, for me, the word cult conjures up images of people sneaking into the woods with red robes on in order to sacrifice pigs at night in some kind of weird blood ritual. Or it makes me think of very uneducated and lonely and desperate people, maybe living in their parents' basement, who are so hungry for friends that they would join any crazy group just to have a sense of belonging. And that was just not my experience. The members of my church were, for the most part, quote-unquote, normal people. They were teachers and small business owners. They were carpenters and blueberry farmers and stay-at-home moms and legal secretaries. We had families. Some of us were certainly poor and uneducated, but others of us had master's degrees in engineering and business administration. But when I really examine our church, there's little doubt that I grew up in a cult, and a doomsday apocalyptic one at that. And it's taken me almost 40 years to be able to admit that out loud. And I know that I am not alone in this. So I think it's time someone actually told this story, don't you think? From 13 Media, I'm Trisha Jenkins, and this is Worldwide, the Unchosen Church.
The World Tomorrow. Herbert W. Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
Before Joel Osteen or Brian Houston or even L. Ron Hubbard, there was Herbert W. Armstrong and his worldwide Church of God.
Time is running out. We're in the stage between World War II and World War III. We are down in the approximate time of the end.
As a child, I never imagined getting married or going to college or having a family. And that's because I was taught that a nuclear World War III was coming at any moment and that I was going to be whisked away to an ancient archaeological site called Petra, which I knew nothing about except that it was a place in the Indiana Jones movies where Indy receives the Holy Grail.
Which one is it?
You must choose. Choose wisely, for as the true grail will bring you life, the false grail will take it from you.
But that was the place where our church taught that we would ride out the end of the world. So while ICBM missiles flew over my head and destroyed everything and everyone on the planet, I would be safe in these desert caves. Me and the other 143,999 members of the church that God called people into. And while being safe and cozy while the world is blowing itself up sounds nice, as a teenager, I was actually afraid that God's kingdom might come just a little bit too soon. I was terrified of being turned into an eternal spirit being before I'd ever had the chance to have sex. And I wasn't the only one who worried about that. The teens in my local congregation actually formed pacts with one another, saying that if we got to the place of safety and we were unattached, we would absolutely marry each other, just so we could know the pleasures of the flesh, before God's kingdom arrived and we lost our physical bodies forever. We also had a slew of other beliefs that were far outside the mainstream. Sick people were not encouraged to go to the doctor. Instead, they were taught to trust that faith and some olive oil on a cloth that had been blessed by a minister could heal all sorts of ailments, including cancer. We weren't allowed to vote in political elections. Christmas, Halloween, Valentine's Day, those were all pagan holidays that were sinful to celebrate. I wasn't even allowed to sing Silent Night at school for fear of participating in a pagan ritual, something that I believed would land me straight into what we called the Lake of Fire.
This is the Hellfire, a lake of fire. This is the second death.
Outside of my parents, Herbert W. Armstrong had more influence over my life than any other adult. Which is weird because I never met him. I'd never even been in the same room as him. All the same, Armstrong loomed very large in my life. The fact that I saw him on television in my living room every Sunday morning on the ABC network also made him feel elevated and special. One of the reasons that Armstrong was particularly successful was that he was an early media adopter. Armstrong came from an advertising background and eventually got interested in religion, founding a small radio ministry. He was on the radio as early as the 1930s and on TV in the 50s. His commanding radio voice and strong television presence helped him buy airtime on national networks. And over the next 5 decades, he and his son, Garner Ted, would really grow that ministry into a multimedia empire.
It was a small and humble beginning, but like the proverbial grain of mustard seed, the work was destined to grow.
The syndicated television program, which in the U.S. aired on ABC on Sunday mornings.
The World Tomorrow. The Worldwide Church of God presents The World Tomorrow with Herbert W. Armstrong.
It also produced 2 magazines, The Good News and The Plain Truth, which boasted a combined circulation of 6 million. Because he was often photographed with world leaders like Margaret Thatcher or President Mubarak or Indira Gandhi, he seemed like a celebrity or some type of evangelical rock star. I didn't realize at the time that a lot of those photos were simply paid photo ops that the church's marketing team were able to secure for Armstrong.
For almost 20 years, Mr. Armstrong traveled thousands of miles, meeting with kings, emperors, presidents, prime ministers, and leaders of many nations. The walls of his study are lined with mementos of those visits, gifts from the leaders of nations great and small.
I probably have visited more heads of government in their own offices than any other man. What do I talk about? I talk about the conditions that they're confronted with. I talk about world conditions and problems, problems that are far greater than they themselves are able to cope with. I go as an ambassador, an unofficial ambassador for world peace. And they received me as an ambassador for world peace.
But Armstrong was fascinating to me because he was also a man of contradictions. On the one hand, he preached in a friendly, almost avuncular way, calling us his friends and even his co-workers. He preached sometimes in an upbeat, happy tone, spreading the news of the world tomorrow, a time of complete utopian world peace that would arrive after Christ's return. In fact, the emblem or the logo for the Worldwide Church of God was a circular seal that featured a lion, a lamb, and a young child all comfortably sitting next to each other, a symbol of just how safe the world tomorrow was going to be. We even had a hymn that we frequently sang at church called It Won't Be Long Now, featuring the same mythology. But while Armstrong presented himself as an ambassador for world peace, he also had a very dark message that thrived on the concepts of destruction and fear. He promised that an impending World War III was coming at any moment, and that war was going to bring famine and nuclear and chemical attacks, pestilence and plagues. He even got Basil Wolverton, a convert to the church and an artist for Mad Magazine and Marvel Comics, to illustrate pictures of the end times for his magazines. These images were terrifying, featuring a series of barren landscapes, bodies covered in boils, hordes of people fleeing nuclear mushroom clouds, and cities in flames as a team of airplanes dropped hydrogen bombs on the people below. If you didn't want to have to endure that tribulation, Armstrong preached, you'd better be a member of God's one true church. Otherwise, you were destined to suffer a horrific death. Armstrong's ministry also confused me as a child. He would often proclaim that members needed to give money to his church so that he could spread the gospel around the world and save as many people as possible before the end times arrived. But he also preached that only 144,000 people would be chosen as God's elect when those end times came. And our church already had close to that many members, so I could never figure out why we were trying to recruit more people. New converts, it seemed to me, just jeopardized my place in the kingdom. So I kind of wanted that ministry to stop. Whether they were on the radio or TV or writing for their magazines, Herbert Armstrong claimed to have been shown directly by God the one true but long-forgotten gospel of the Bible that would lead to eternal salvation. D.J. Grothy, a former member of the WCG, describes Armstrong in this way.
Herbert W. Armstrong, whom we've taught since the early 30s, is the true end-time apostle of God. He was sort of a well-meaning, and that's debatable, well-meaning ad man. I now see Armstrong in that tradition of American innovators. What he did was look around and look at all these other kooky, interesting religions, and he did a sort of greatest hits. He picked and chose the best doctrines from all the wacky fringes. So like the Seventh-day Adventist, you keep the Sabbath. And like the Messianic Jews, you keep the holy days. Like the Jehovah's Witnesses, you don't celebrate Christmas. Like Christian Science, you don't go to doctors, but by his stripes you're healed. He shoehorned a set of beliefs that would seem otherwise very incompatible with all of these others and somehow put them all together in a coherent whole.
But just because you hold some wacky beliefs doesn't actually mean that you've started a cult. So I wanted to research what the actual definition of a cult was. And I found that it's defined as a group or a movement that's usually held together by a shared commitment to either a charismatic leader or to an ideology that seems strange to mainstream society. But it also offers up a belief system that has all of the answers to all of life's questions. And it offers a special solution to be gained only by following the group's rules. It also purports to have special knowledge that's not available to everyone. But it's also a little bit more complicated than that. This is Dr. Steve Hassan, a former member of the Moonies cult, who is now a licensed mental health counselor and one of the leading thinkers on cult mentalities.
So the way I think about it is I think about an influence continuum from ethical to unethical influence. And so I think about cults along that influence continuum from ethical, productive, benign to authoritarian cults. And I define authoritarian cults in terms of controlling people's behavior, their information, their thoughts, and their emotions, what I refer to as my BITE model of authoritarian control. And a lot of authoritarian cults have leaders that are malignant narcissists who want power, money, and sex. I have worked with victims of Armstrong's Worldwide Church of God, and I do characterize it as an authoritarian cult that uses the BITE model of methods to create pseudo-selves that are dependent and obedient.
And once Dr. Hassan said that the WCG was an authoritarian cult, I started to see the church in a new light, and things started coming back to me. Like the way the church disfellowshipped and punished dissenters, even for minor infractions. In fact, my husband, who was raised in the WCG in Australia, once got kicked out for a while for refusing to cut his hair as short as the ministers wanted, and also for refusing to take out an earring. His parents and five other families were also once disfellowshipped for 9 months, shunned by the church, because they dared to question whether or not some of the country's newest ministers were being too liberal or relaxed in their adherence to Armstrong's rules.
When I was a child growing up in the Worldwide Church of God, Herbert W. Armstrong was second only to God in my conception of the hierarchy of the universe.
Our ministers also taught that our leader was not just infallible, but that he was God's chosen apostle, and that God spoke directly to us through him.
Jesus wasn't really a part of it. Jesus was hardly ever talked about. My Catholic grandparents had a crucified Jesus on the wall, and it really freaked me out because in my mind, that was pagan. Like, our church just didn't talk about Jesus. It was God, and Herbert W. Armstrong was the apostle, and he was God's representative, and his voice and his physical appearance and his presence, that really gave me my conception of God. You know, God was an old, white-haired, white guy who was authoritarian and was always correct, and if you were wrong, he would smite you with righteous anger, and his voice would shake, and he would shake his fist and pound his desk. It was a very narrow, masculine conception of a God.
The church also used fear tactics, preaching that you would lose your salvation if you ever left the church or failed to follow its rules. It also had a charismatic leader who demanded that members put 20 and sometimes 30% of their income towards the church. And it even encouraged members to leave their homes in their wills, not to their children, but to the Worldwide Church of God. And it worked to control its members' social circles, preventing them from dating and marrying outside of the organization, and even telling them who they could marry inside of it, especially as it came to issues of race. Although church membership never really climbed above 150,000 during its peak years in the 1980s, the wealth that the church produced was astounding. Those members were giving, in what would be today's dollars, over $380 million annually. And that money not only helped fund the church's media empire, it also helped it build three college campuses for ministerial training, and it even helped build the lavish Ambassador Auditorium in Pasadena, California, which still stands today. Most notoriously, that money also kept its leadership in luxurious lifestyles that included private Learjets and limousines and chauffeurs and second homes and expensive home furnishings. In fact, the church's financial status eventually raised the attention of both the California Attorney General and Mike Wallace of CBS's 60 Minutes. Both groups investigated the church in the late 1970s when a group of members began to suspect the church of financial misappropriation. This is a clip from that 60 Minutes expose.
Mammon is the story of money and the Worldwide Church of God based in Pasadena, California. It is a tale of backbiting and power struggle, of fat expense accounts and disinheritance in a church whose 100,000 members each year contribute $80 million. That is more money than is collected by Billy Graham and Oral Roberts combined. It is the story of Herbert W. Armstrong, founder of the Worldwide Church of God, of his son Garner Ted, once thought of as heir apparent, who has now been cast out of the church by his father, and of an unlikely church figure, an accountant, lawyer, and businessman, chief advisor to Herbert Armstrong, Stanley Rader. Finally, it is the story of how the state of California is now trying to hold the Worldwide Church of God accountable for all the tax-exempt money that pours into its Pasadena headquarters.
By 1979, the California Attorney General's investigation into those allegations resulted in the WCG being placed in a court-ordered receivership for more than a year. But it was during this time that Stanley Rader was also able to organize other religious groups. And with the backing of a nonprofit religious lobbying coalition, he was actually able to thwart the state. The group introduced a bill into the California legislature, which essentially restricted the Attorney General's authority to conduct civil financial investigations of religious and nonprofit organizations. And after that bill got passed, the California Attorney General's office just dropped its suit against the church. Herbert W. Armstrong passed away a few years later in 1986. And just before he passed, he appointed a successor. He was the son of Czechoslovakian immigrants named Joseph Dikach, on whom Armstrong bestowed the title of Pastor General of the Worldwide Church of God. Interestingly, Armstrong refused to transfer the title of apostle to Joseph, but I guess it didn't really matter because Dikach would just later bestow that title on himself anyway. What's more interesting to me about that transfer of power is that about 8 years into Dikach's leadership, he gave what is now called the Christmas Eve Sermon in 1994, or what members of the church would now simply refer to as the changes. It was in this sermon that Dikach actually started to reverse nearly all of Armstrong's teachings and steer the WCG towards mainstream evangelical Christianity. Keeping the Sabbath, giving tithes, eating only clean meats, avoiding doctors, refusing to celebrate Christmas, those were no longer things that we were required to do to be saved, said Dikach. Those were Old Testament teachings, or Armstrong's particular brand of Christianity. All that was required to be saved and now, he said, was a belief and a faith in Jesus Christ, and actions that worked to do good in the world and demonstrate that faith. I remember that sermon well because I was actually sitting in the fourth row when it was delivered at Ambassador University.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Pastor General of the Worldwide Church of God, Joseph W. Dikach.
This is going to be a long afternoon, and so hopefully, if you did happen to bring a lunch, then it's to your advantage. But nevertheless, we're here to gain a better understanding of what God does require of us. Before, it was more or less pray and pay. Don't worry about anything else. All you were required to do is send your tithes in, read the literature, and shut up. It goes beyond that. Faith is also required. We have to believe. I'll show you that God expects more than a tithe.
What happened in the following years was tumultuous, to say the least. Half of the church's members thought that Dikach made good sense. And eventually, over time, they started gravitating towards mainstream congregations in their own hometowns, which were just closer than their WCG churches, which members often had to drive more than an hour each way to attend. But the other half of the church's membership? Well, they were mad. They basically said, "Oh no, how dare you, you false prophet?" And they got up and left. They started their own churches, which retained Armstrong's teachings. And those churches are still very much around today. What made this whole thing even more difficult was that sometimes members of the exact same family reacted in very different ways, causing household schisms, which were painful and hard to handle, because members felt like their loved one's salvation was on the line. This is a clip from the documentary Called to Be Free, which expresses how many members felt about the changes when they first came to fruition.
How could we have been so theologically ignorant?
We did not understand grace.
But this was catastrophic because it challenged everything.
I don't know of anything like this that has ever happened. It was a showdown. It was a Dodge City high noon.
It's nothing short of miraculous.
It's the whole belief system that's in error. It can't be fixed.
Part of the reason why these changes were such a shock is that for years, members had been sacrificing in their daily lives in order to be a part of this church. I think Lisa Mezzobonet summarizes this sentiment really well.
When the changes happened, we stopped being special. Our leader, he basically got up behind the podium and said, we've been wrong. And the rest of Protestant Christianity has been right. And so in one fell swoop, we stopped being special and we didn't know how to be normal. And that was really hard for me because of the sacrifices that I made while I was growing up, right? All that sacrifice was because I wanted to do the things that God said he wanted. And so when the church came along and said, no, God doesn't want those things, we've been wrong, I was like, so my suffering doesn't even mean anything. And he didn't even freaking want it. Like, that is not okay. And that was extremely difficult for me to deal with.
And it was difficult for a lot of people. In fact, in the following years after the changes were announced, the Worldwide Church of God's membership dropped pretty drastically. Some suspect the church lost more than half of its membership. And today, if you Google the Worldwide Church of God, you'll see that once Tkach took the church in a more mainstream direction, it eventually rebranded itself, and it now calls itself Grace Communion International. But like I said, that doesn't mean that Armstrongism is dead. It is still very much alive and well in the 2020s, in what are now known as the Churches of God. Splinter groups like the United Church of God, or the Philadelphia Church of God, or the Church of God Worldwide Associated, or CAGWA. In fact, Dr. David Barrett, who wrote an entire book and dissertation on the schisms of the WCG over the decades, says that there are over 400 modern-day offshoots or splinter groups that have come from the Worldwide Church of God. I feel like whenever the stories of these types of churches are told, though, that they're mostly focused on the stories of the leaders. Why they wanted to start the church, why they started their own church, what abuses of power they inflicted on members. And that's been true of the WCG, too. A lot of scholars and theologians have examined Armstrong's rise in American culture, but the research, the interviews, the public records that are all employed in telling those stories mostly come from the church's top leadership. It's administrators, it's pastor generals, it's policy setters. But these are not the stories that I want to tell. I want to use this series to look at the stories of the people who lived the church as regular members. I want to tell the stories of the church's Black members, its female members, its gay members, its poor members, the stories of second-generation members who were told their whole lives that they were special, only to be told when they reached adulthood that that was all a lie. I also want to tell the stories of people who rejected Tkach's move towards mainstream Christianity and joined a splinter group instead, and who are only now just coming out of one of the Churches of God and charting a new course for their life. I want to tell these stories because while Armstrong was living high on the hog in Pasadena, California, flying on Learjets to meet world leaders for photo opportunities, it was the average member who suffered. They were the ones who lost loved ones because they didn't seek medical attention. They were the ones who didn't save for retirement or for their children's college education because they thought that the world was going to end in the next few months or maybe years. So the rest of this series is devoted to telling those stories, the stories of everyday members who survived the Worldwide Church of God, who paid a heavy price for investing so much in a doomsday apocalyptic cult, but who also took away the best parts that that church had to offer in order to help them thrive in their lives outside of it. In short, this series is like my strange love letter to the regular folks of the WCG like me, whose stories deserve to be told. And I hope that after this series, they might finally feel seen enough to say in an icebreaker, "Hi, my name is X, and I grew up in a doomsday apocalyptic cult called the Worldwide Church of God." And people might know what that actually means. Next up on Worldwide, the Unchosen Church.
They didn't believe strongly in doctors.
They don't know the cause of cancer, and consequently, they don't know the one proper and sure cure. In fact, there's only one real cure, and that is that from God.
It's, you know, there's this beautiful little three-year-old, and they tried everything, every type of prayer they could. These why questions never got answered to my satisfaction, and so for me, rebellion became my way.
Jesse Moskal faced the death penalty for one drug charge and a life sentence for another in a Thailand prison.
Unless you want to risk the lake of fire, we suggest you listen to that next episode on Apple Podcasts or wherever podcasts are made available. I would like to extend a special thanks to Nathaniel O'Reilly, DJ Grothy, and Lisa Metzel-Bonet, who all contributed to this episode. I'd also like to thank Joel Kramer, who gave us permission to use clips from his documentary, Call to Be Free, which you can watch on YouTube for free. Worldwide, The Unchosen Church is written, produced, and hosted by me, Trisha Jenkins, editing and sound design by 13 Media, music licensed by Soundstripe. If you'd like to send us a question or comment, please reach out via email at worldwidepod11@gmail.com or DM us on social media. You can find us on Instagram at worldwidepod and on Twitter and Facebook at worldwidepod11. So long as the mark of the beast has not yet appeared, we hope you'll join us again.